Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Welcome to the ID10T podcast number 981. Hey, let's go to the corkboard where things are happening. The corkboard where your feet's a tapping and having a good time submitting to the corkboard events at ID10T.com.
Events at ID10T.com.
I should have ended that on a major seventh. Dot com. That's probably not a major seventh, but it's that really nice chord. I've already ruined the bit. You know what? Next time, have better musical training. That's what I've learned from this impromptu skit. But let's go to the corkboard. Kids Land is a mom and pop and baby store in Los Angeles, and we're celebrating our 32nd year on February 7th, 2019. The event is curated for new and expected parents to learn from baby experts and brand representatives. And just for fun, we hold a huge raffle for everyone who attends the event. Tickets can be purchased through our website, kidslandusa.com. And if they use the code ID10T, we will offer 50% off their ticket. Oh, look at you, Kidsland, throwing an offer code in there. Nice, I like it. Also, I wrote a time travel novel called The Glove, and it's up on Amazon in paperback or digital form, available to purchase now, on demand. I demand to read The Glove now. It's been a long time coming. I've always wanted to add a story to the time travel genre. Here is the blurb for the book. After Ben Stanley's son is born, he suddenly finds himself on a time traveling journey from his own past. For a man whose life hasn't turned out the way he thought it would, Ben now has the chance to change everything for the better. Will Ben be corrupted by this newfound power, or will he use it for good? This mind-bending journey through the best and worst of times of his life will force him to reevaluate what's important and ultimately what makes him happy. The Glove on Amazon. Nice job, Dave. I'm very proud of you that you wrote a thing, that you wrote a glove. And now people can go get it again. Events at ID10T.com. This episode is Mr. Seth Green, whom I've known, I think, maybe since we were teenagers, but if not real, real, real close, since the 1900s, since the early to mid 90s. And I don't know what to say other than I love him. I love the shit out of him. Seth is just, he's just likable and talented and industrious, and he makes a lot of cool stuff. And he just is kind of like, he's carved out his own path as a creator while also carving out his own path as an actor. And now he's adding directing to that. He's got a movie that he directed called Changeland, which is not out yet, but we do talk about it quite a bit. I saw it and it's great. And when it does come out, you should see it. I don't know when that is yet, but when it does, you should. He doesn't know that either. I'm not being an irresponsible host. There really is no information on that yet, but it's great, and you should see Changeland when it comes out. And just love this guy so much! So thank you, Seth Green, for coming on the ID10T podcast, which was brought to you by Squarespace.com. Let's talk a little bit about some things you can do with Squarespace. You can turn your idea into a new website. You can showcase your work. You can publish a blog. You can promote your physical or online business, announce an upcoming or special event project or more. And they're going to do this by giving you beautiful templates created by world-class designers. Powerful e-commerce functionality lets you sell anything online. You can customize it.
Get everything you need for mobile right out of the box. You can buy domains, choose from over 200 extensions. Analytics are going to help you grow in real time. 24/7 award-winning customer support. Nothing to patch or upgrade ever. So make it yourself. Easily create a website by yourself. Make it stand out. Stand out with a beautiful website. Check out squarespace.com/ID10T for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use the offer code ID10T to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. So thanks to Squarespace for sponsoring this episode of the ID10T podcast, which is Mr. Seth Green coming at your face via your ears. Via your ears. Still not the major seventh. I'm gonna get it.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
Seth Green's in the kitchen talking to my wife. Seth Green's in the kitchen and he's talking to my wife because my wife made juice out of stalks of celery. My wife made me drink a glass full of celery. She says it's good for me.
She told me it's good.
Is it good?
Have you looked through it yet?
Yeah, it's amazing.
Kind of awesome, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, we're talking about the Dungeons & Dragons Art and Arcana visual history book, which
Joe Manganiello reached out to me about all of the Frazetta stuff that they're doing. Yep. Have you seen all that?
Yeah.
Pretty awesome.
Yeah. There's a thing this week, I think.
Yeah, he's got like, it's like a 3-day pop-up or something like that.
That is fantastic!
Yeah.
You know, Seth, that just dovetails nicely into the first thing that I wanted to ask about, which is, we're not crazy, right? Because we, you of all people, understand the... someone who has a bunch of toys in his own house and is trying to figure out how to build a water park in his backyard and a putt-putt course. We're not wrong, right? Listen, being frozen in our youth, that's okay.
Well, I wouldn't say that I'm frozen in my youth because I don't issue responsibility and I don't shy away from doing typically adult things. I just think that I've retained some of my youthful enthusiasm.
Good answer.
And I don't feel like being passionate about my interests is a negative.
Good. Oh, thank God. Good.
Yeah.
Good.
I mean, obviously there's boundaries to it, you know, and the older I get, the more I've tried to streamline different collections so that I don't feel overwhelmed in my home by stuff.
Right.
But there are different totems and different iconography that I like to see because I find them inspiring or I find them encouraging or I find them to be reminders of a place when I was inspired or encouraged.
Someone's basically just frozen that quote and they've put it on a thing and it's going to get posted on Reddit somewhere about this is why I collect stuff and it's okay.
Yeah.
Be okay with you. Because you, like I did, we're fortunate enough to marry someone who understands and also engages in the similar types of passionate fandom.
Yeah. Well, she argued the same thing, that before we met, she didn't realize that she could have a boyfriend that would let her play video games and be interested in her success or anything like that.
Yeah, because she and I are from the same town.
Yeah.
Memphis. And I'm sure I know there's nerds in Memphis because I knew I think all of them when I was growing up. So there was just a few, but you know, it was a different time. It was a different time back then.
Yeah.
When we were growing up, things are different now.
We're lucky enough to have lived through a kind of revolution where all of the pop that we were in love with as kids has become financially successful. Where all of these more fringe genre things have become like global pop sensations. And mm-hmm. So it's almost as if our interests have been validated. Every Every punch in the face I took for loving Spider-Man has now been proven worthwhile because the path for my children will be much easier.
They're not going to be into that stuff, though. They'll be into
sports. Something.
Yeah, I know. Like, someday when we have kids, I know I'm going to have to go to, like, a sports game.
Well, I do wonder about that, like, being born into a world where Star Wars always existed and there's so many ways to live the experience, you know, now that Disney is building a theme park environment where you can have your own cantina shootout experience. Like, what is that going to do to the way a kid is introduced to those concepts? Like, for me, Star Wars, even though it was a global phenomenon, the 20 years after Return of the Jedi came out, before there was new Star Wars, there was just this barren space where the only thing you had was your memory and how long you could retain your excitement for it. And then the reason I think it felt so personal is because it wasn't everybody on the planet that loved Star Wars in those 20 plus years. It was just the people who loved it so much that they were like, oh, do you remember this specific moment?
Right.
And now that it has become this much larger thing, which is being added to every day in all these other media outlets, whether it's animation or TV shows or more movies or side movies that are based on a single line from one of the original movies.
Right.
It's a completely different world. And so I wonder what that's going to look like to a kid, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess because obviously everyone knew the movie when it came out. It was one of the biggest films in history, but that's different than diving deep into the fandom. It's not like if the Godfather fans have been like, did you see the one where Corleone drops the guy in the it's like in the Sarlacc pit. You know, it's like there is that kind of fandom, but there was such a ripe universe to play in that went so much farther and broader and deeper than just going, oh, that this movie changed film and it changed the way entertainment is done. Star Wars has always been popular, but not like that.
Yeah. Well, and also a story about Lando as a teenager is going to be far more interesting than the side saga about the one guy who shot Joe Pesci in Goodfellas.
Who's the equivalent of, like,
I bet he was in a street racing.
In Goodfellas, it's just like, oh, I wanted this really obscure character, and I just want to learn all I can about him and get his action figure.
Like, when are we going to get the Johnny Two-Time side story?
You're going to get it twice. I'm going to tell you my story.
That'd be terrible.
Yeah, the Goodfellas. I'm sure now there are probably Goodfellas action figures because pop culture is not a satire, but pop culture is a pop culture celebration of itself now,
yeah,
as opposed to the things that it's actually making. I mean, like, I love that I have Golden Girl Funko, Pop Funkos.
Me too.
But, or there are Golden Girls Clue,
right,
game. But pop culture is just, like, collapsing on itself. And I'm, you know, like, in 20 years, are the things that are being made now going to feel nostalgic in the same way, or is everyone just sort of take it all for granted because it's not, like, entertainment isn't really precious anymore because there's just so much of it.
But I do think there's something to be said for the things that got to you when you were young. You know, like, I'm noticing a lot of kids in their 20s now reflective of 90s culture the same way that we were reflective of 80s culture. And if you really look back, our parents were reflective of 60s and 70s
absolutely
culture. So I think that's
just... But not
just,
to this degree.
But I don't think manufacturing was available to this degree. Like, we've got so many different outlets that just didn't exist. We've got so many points of access that didn't exist. Like, I don't know. There's MASH action figures. There's Love Boat action figures. So we were definitely doing that. It just didn't... It didn't have the same respectability.
Community. It's all about community. Yeah. The communities now, the internet has given people, like, clubhouses, basically,
yeah,
just digital clubhouses to connect with one another and strengthen the numbers. Like, we didn't know. I mean, I'm sure there were a lot of people, you know, who were just as obsessed with Nine Nub as anyone else.
Right.
Like, but you couldn't really connect to those people if they didn't live in your town,
yeah,
if they didn't go to your particular hobby shop,
yeah,
or whatever. So now it's just all of these people can find each other and, you know, and have strength in numbers.
And I think that's encouraging. Like, I think what made me and many other kids who were so interested in all that stuff feel so alone was that lack of connection, that lack of community, that you had to drive all the way to San Diego once a year to meet other people who knew the same volume of things that you did. And it was before the concept of San Diego Comic-Con became so popular that it attracted people who weren't even as passionately interested in the stuff.
What was it? Were you on the podcast like 5 years ago or something? Was it a crazy long time ago?
The last time I did your podcast?
Yeah.
It was a long time ago.
It was a really long time ago.
It doesn't seem like it because we see each other in real life.
All the time.
So we just sort of have these conversations anyway.
Did you tell the story? Was that when you told me the story of the pizza commercials that you did? And maybe you did tell that on the podcast. What was the commercial?
The burger commercial? The cha-ching?
The cha-ching guy. Yeah. Did you tell that story on the podcast?
Probably. I did Dax Shepard's podcast. And since we worked together in 2002 and he found out that that was a thing, he's become obsessed with that whole concept. Just the same way that I thought it was insane. I had been working for 15 years as a successful actor before I got that commercial, which made me more famous in some regions than any of the on-camera work that I had done. And it completely negated anyone's awareness of me as a performer. When I went to New Orleans to lead the crowd at the Superdome in a cha-ching cheer, I was a series regular on an ABC show with Terry Garr from the people that made Soap. And nobody knew anything about that. But to them, I was just the cha-ching guy.
But isn't that like, you've lived a very specific experience of fame versus success.
Right.
And you have been a successful actor since you could walk. And that fame thing was just a different thing.
It really was.
How do you, you know, it's sort of looking at like how you define fame versus success. Is one necessarily better than the other, or can they work together?
Well, I love pop in general, and I really do love people. And so these kinds of things that happen where people all collect around an idea that is totally separate from any of your individual achievement. Like I looked at it as a way that I got to play the Beatles without having to permanently be the Beatles, right? So I could go to New Orleans and be the cha-ching guy where I literally couldn't walk down the street without armed police officers protecting me from this fevered crowd that just wanted to touch the cha-ching guy
like a
sacred Bible being passed down the aisles. It was really...
You were the Ark. When they revealed you at the stadium, everyone's face melted. Right?
Yeah.
You were the Ark of the Covenant.
Yeah, it was pretty incredible.
Yeah.
But no, I had seen enough people become catastrophically famous in real life that I could appreciate that this type of fame I was enjoying in that moment was completely impersonal. It had nothing to do with me at all. It was a fever around an idea. And to that end, I was able to be this totem, for lack of a better word, for everyone to put their shared excitement. And like, people just get excited about sports because we as human beings need to commune around stuff. And that's a high point of energy. You get to play out a lot of emotional roller coasters by watching sports. And so the cha-ching concept, it just sort of piggybacked onto fans' enthusiasm for sports and communion in general. They all wanted something to chant together, right? So that's the way that they were able to express it. But it had nothing to do with me. People even said to me in New Orleans, "Hey, you think you might stick with this acting thing?" I was like, I do. I think I will. Yeah,
feel like it's working out.
Like I'd already made 8 movies at that point. Several
what
pilots.
What year was that?
I had just turned 18, so that had to be like 92 maybe.
Was that early on?
Yeah.
And you had already made that? Jesus Christ.
Yeah. This is very funny. And I'd already moved out to LA full time. I'd already done Radio Days and It. And I'd done a good amount of work by then. And literally no one had any idea who the fuck I was.
And
they were like, "You're that cha-ching guy." And I was like, "Yep, cha-ching."
And still, even after that, it's just like thinking about how many things you've worked on.
Actually, I wasn't even 18. I was 17 because I turned 18 the year after that when I did Airborne and found out that the cha-ching guy was very popular in Cincinnati where we shot, but that there'd been a rumor that the cha-ching guy got so much money from doing those commercials that he bought some fancy car and drove off a Mulholland. And I was like,
oh my God, I'm so sorry to hear about that.
Yeah, it was really tragic.
I'm sorry you died.
The poor Cha-Ching guy.
In a way, it's kind of funny that like the Cha-Ching guy just gets to go off in a blaze of glory.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah, he's like full Bon Jovi.
But that he's his own entity.
Yeah.
And that you didn't have to, like, the lore around him sort
right,
of
like
took care of itself.
Like, if Clara Peller had tried to move on from Where's
you
the Beef
You mean the Where's the Beef Lady,
yeah,
yes.
To being in the First Wives Club or whatever, it wouldn't have translated as well. Like, if you saw the Where's the Beef Lady show up on Golden Girls, she would always be the Where's the Beef Lady. But I had inexplicably been able to dodge that, and just a few short years later was a series regular on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and starring next to John Malkovich in Knock Around Guys.
I think a lot
nobody
of
nobody knew that was the
I think
same
a lot of that
person.
Has to do with the fact that you had worked a ton before, and also, if you had done the Cha-Ching commercials for years, then yeah. that might have been one thing. But it was just, yeah. it was just like such a slice of time that it happened, and also, you know, like if. If Clara Peller had been accepted a bunch of Where's the Beef stuff, like if she turned up on Golden Girls
right.
and,
saying Where's the
you know,
beef?
Like a guy came out in a towel after Blanche, coming out of Blanche's bedroom and she's like, Where's the beef? And everyone fucking laughed. Then, you know, it's like then she would be cementing herself as that more, like making those choices. But that's sort of the trade-off of like, well, what do you want? Do you want... You know, quick fame and quick money. Do you want longevity? If you want longevity, you kind of have to think a little more. You have to think a little bit differently about the types of choices that you want to make.
Some of it's also attitude. I'll never forget when Travolta did Pulp Fiction and then hosted SNL. And he came out and in his monologue made reference to Saturday Night Fever and Look Who's Talking and like all of the sketches that he did on the show. He did a Welcome Back Cotter sketch, and he just wasn't shy about acknowledging any of the things that anybody would love him for. In fact, he seemed really able to appreciate the fact that people loved him for all of those things. And so he was willing to say, yes, I am all of these things, and that's why you love me. And so instead of being embarrassed and saying, I'm not that, I'm nominated for an Oscar now, and I'm serious because I'm not the Where's the Welcome Back Cotter guy, instead he was generously acknowledging of the audience's love for him no matter where it came
from. Yeah, because I think people
forget. I thought that was a really good...
Well, people forget he went through a bit of a dip in between Look Who's Talking and Pulp Fiction. Yeah. And it was almost I almost feel like there was a little tongue-in-cheek that he was hired in Pulp Fiction. Like, oh, it's Travolta. And then he's fucking amazing in it. And everyone's like, oh, wait a minute.
And the
oh, yeah,
amazing.
He's an amazing actor. That's, you know, that's right.
Oh, yeah, John Travolta's a movie star, isn't he?
What is the – would you please tell the story about the cheeseburger and Travolta?
Oh, this is just – because he's the nicest guy. He's we're on set of Old Dogs. And I had a couple of scenes with John, but all my scenes were with John and Robin Williams. And so we had one day where the beginning of the scene is me and John, and then Robin doesn't come in until later. And so the whole morning we're just there by ourselves doing a scene together, which he was so cool and excited. He's like, I just think we should do some improv together. I'm like, whatever you want, John, I'm down for this. And he said, listen, when Robin shows up, no matter what time it is, I'm going to look at you and we'll pretend like we're in the middle of some really great joke, okay? And we'll just laugh together and laugh. And then we'll say, oh, Robin, you missed the whole morning. It was so much fun. I'm like, okay, this is a funny prank. I'm totally with you. So we're waiting. And then Robin comes to work. And John looks at me like, oh, not now. And he just starts laughing really big. And I laugh really big. And Robin walks up to us and I go, oh, Robin, you should have been here. John just made the funniest joke. We've been having such a great time all morning. And John cannot hold this gag for even a second. He goes, I told him to say that, Robin. I always feel left out of your jokes. I just really wanted a moment myself.
But, oh, that's so sweet.
But I love you. I can't make you feel bad. And I was like, you're... This guy, he's just adorable. But while we were...
How did Robin take that, by the way?
He just looked at like, oh, okay.
All right, so should I...
So you want me to...
I'm here. We're going to...
Sounds great. Okay. Whatever you guys are doing. Okay. And then... But earlier in the day, John told me this story about making... I can't remember what it was. He made a movie with Robert Duvall and...
Phenomenon?
Oh, it must have been, right? So he's talking about Robert Duvall, who he just calls Bobby. And he's like, you know, Bobby Duvall, he likes to cook as well. And I'm like, oh, are you a cook? And he goes, well, I like to eat, so I have to learn to cook. And he said, you know, if you had to pick a favorite food, what do you like? And I go, I love food. I love all kinds of things. I love pasta. I love pizzas. I love hamburgers. And he goes, what's your favorite kind of hamburger? And I said, oh, man, well, I'm kind of a purist. I just love a really well-cooked, normal burger. And I usually just put cheese on it, but I don't like any garnish. And he's like, I don't like any garnish. No lettuce, no tomato, no ketchup, no mayo. I was like, yeah, that's pretty great. And he goes, what kind of bread? And I was like, oh, I don't know, I'll take a good bun. I like a Hawaiian bun is good. And he goes, have you ever had a burger on an English muffin? And I was like, ooh, I haven't, but I love English muffins. He goes, you know what? Hey, Sam, can you come in for a second? So wait, would you make sure? And he just starts instructing someone to get a burger made for me. Well, because there's a chef. He has a chef that cooks him lunch and stuff. And so he told this assistant to tell the chef to make me a burger. And I laughed about it because I was like, oh, yeah, whatever. And then 20 minutes later, a burger is delivered to me in my trailer. And it is on an English muffin, perfectly cooked. I don't even remember if it had cheese. But I am like eating this burger. And it's so good that I almost can't take it. And my door in my trailer is open. And Kelly Preston walks by. And she goes, you got it. And I go, this is amazing. And she goes, pretty good, huh? And I go, but I love more than anything that he was like, I need a burger for Seth Green. And in 20 minutes, there's a hamburger in my hands. And she just sort of shrugs her shoulders and says, well, he's John Travolta. And I thought, yeah,
That's
really true.
He's a wizard.
It's really true. He's the type of guy who can just snap his fingers and you've got the best hamburger you've ever eaten.
But like a nice guy.
Yeah, he's the best. I fucking love that guy.
That's so, that's so sweet. But yeah. You know, the thing that, one of the things that I admire most about you, not besides your work ethic, which is unbelievable.
Oh, this from the guy who literally works all day.
You know what though? But there's something about your general demeanor and attitude and outlook is so positive and so like, whatever happens. Like you seem to have the best of both worlds. Like you have some of the workaholic gene, but you don't seem to be a prisoner of it in the way like that it doesn't seem to, unless you're really good at hiding it, that it doesn't seem to affect your demeanor. Like if someone met you, they go, what a laid back guy.
Yeah.
Like how are you able to focus so much and still have such a great general attitude and be such a kind of a laid back, affable?
I'm sure some of it is just the time in which you see me, because I definitely have my bad moments. I just try to keep them private.
Oh, gotcha.
Well, I remember in the early 90s seeing like a series of pictures of Tom Cruise, and every picture of him was just like huge smile and having a great time. And I said to a friend of mine, man, every time you see Tom Cruise, he is just smiling. He goes, what the fuck does he have to frown about? And I was like, oh my God, I guess you're right. What does he have to frown about? But it is that general philosophy of, you know, if you are most people don't become actors because they want to be leaders or instructors, or that they even intend to be an example. They just like to perform, you know, or some people want to be famous, which is a whole different category. But for me, I just love acting. I have learned over the years that all of these things come hand in hand with being successful, which is being able to manage your own mood, being able to not take things personally and not get too defeated. And I've been saying a fair amount lately that I am just as susceptible to the crippling insecurities and self-doubt and like depth of depression that anyone who has any kind of success can experience. But I don't, I do my best to recognize that those moments are not permanent, and that they shouldn't be my definition. And that the magic trick is always being able to go out on stage and, you know, convince the audience of something, that magic exists. Even if you yourself are weeping backstage just before you step onto the stage.
Right.
You know? So as far as an attitude goes, I've been on so many sets, and it just, you're never rewarded for making it about you. There is no upside to no one is ever impressed when you stomp your foot or scream like a child. Like you never convince anyone through brute force.
Right.
I mean, you can force your way through stuff, but no one's going to like you.
Right.
And you may get this one job, but you won't be hired again.
Right.
You know, people really only work with people that they want to work with. Mm-hmm. Even if there is some kind of huge benefit to collaborating with you, people rarely collaborate with assholes more than once.
Right.
Yeah. And that's for me. So from a longevity standpoint, I've seen so many people do this right and wrong, and I just try to be self-aware enough to do it right.
Because as long as you know, your career has pretty much spanned your life, and you've seen a lot of people come and go. You've worked with a lot of people. I'm sure you grew up with a lot of people that maybe didn't make the jump to adult performer.
A lot of people quit. A lot of people die.
Yeah, a lot of people rage quit. You know, like it's just been a lot of there's been a lot, and so there really is something to. Like that is such a feat in and of itself to just be able to keep your head down and stay in the game and still work on great stuff and then also be a creator. And, you know, now as you venture into film directing too, I mean, it's just is there anything else that's kind of kept your head in the game during all those periods where you saw where you saw firsthand front row seat of people falling out for various reasons?
Just my passion for performing has always driven me. It's the fact that whenever I go too long a period of time without acting, that I am just terribly unhappy. So, knowing that my goal is to stay employed as a performer, I then try to stack the deck in my favor in any way that I can. I know. That to maintain any level of success, it requires a constant evolution, a constant self-reflection, and honest looking at the landscape. And I mean, I can shrug my shoulders the same as that, throw up my hands and say, well, why am I not this or that? But the truth is there's always something either beyond your control or something that you're not doing that's keeping you from whatever your goals are. So I try not to get in my own way or any of that.
Because in the movie that you made, Changeland, which, by the way, when the fuck did you go to Thailand to shoot a movie? I feel like I remember there was a period where you were traveling a lot.
Yeah.
But
I spent 3 months in Thailand on my prep, on the shoot, and on the wrap down. We went – it was the summer of 17, and then I spent a good amount of time editing and finishing it.
I mean, I guess I remember. I mean, I do have memories of you going off, but I also maybe it's just because time moves so fast.
Yeah.
Like when I saw the movie, because the movie's like a real, like it's epically shot. Like you're like in. You know, when it opened, I was like, oh, I wonder if they just shot some exteriors in Thailand. Like, no, it's in Thailand. Like, you're in Thailand.
Yeah, part of the reason why I wanted to make the movie was I took a trip to Thailand with a friend of mine, and everything that we did was so magical. It was an extraordinary vacation. But everywhere we went, funny things happened. It was in 2009, and so Obama had just been elected, and the whole world really thought that the U.S. was very progressive, and they knew that like gay culture was on the rise and that, you know, it was going to be legally okay for gay people to get married. And so when my male friend and I showed up in Thailand and went to all these places that are typically reserved for honeymooners, everyone just treated us like we were a couple and like beautiful roses all over our beds and like candlelit dinners being prepared for us. And my buddy and I just laughed that we almost owe it to these people to fuck tonight. Like everybody's putting so much effort.
The conditions are very positive for that. I mean, it's a nice, they put rose petals on the bed. Yeah. It's very lovely.
Well, so when I was there on that trip, everything that happened to us felt cinematic. And I just started making notes because I thought, oh, this is a really funny story to tell. This is a very beautiful backdrop for some kind of emotional development. And I didn't have any of the story that's in the movie, I simply had a series of set pieces that I knew would be incredible to photograph. And I really thought, well, if I can make a compelling narrative around all of this visual, this would be a kind of cinematic vacation for the audience and be a way that people get to explore something that I was lucky enough to see first person, but with an emotional through line that would keep them engaged.
The only thing about the movie that made me uncomfortable was watching your best friend flirt with your wife.
Isn't that funny? Everybody, I
mean, your best friend in real life flirt with your with Claire. Your
I wife, know that right. Everybody's going to have an issue with that, and it's just some of it is that you know, when Claire and I first met and we were just friends, we had very honest conversations about acting in love scenes with other people and how impersonal that whole experience is, but how you'll work with people who can make it personal or who don't understand that it's just a performance and can't separate that, or their process to feel those emotions is to actually feel those emotions. And she and I, neither of us feel that way. We're both incredibly professional about those scenes. And while we're like, you know, wholly committed in the moment after the fact, we're not really trying to hook up with
co-stars.
No, of course not. Well, so knowing that as a real thing about her gave me some comfort in casting her in that role, which I wrote for her because there was nobody who was going to play that role better than
her. She's great in it.
Is she great in that? Because Brecken, there's no co-star I'd rather have than Brecken. I also know Brecken in real life, and there were a lot of things about this. So one, I knew Brecken and Claire really actually love each other in real life.
Yeah,
like they're actually like good friends and wouldn't do anything to hurt each other, wouldn't do anything to hurt me. Neither one of them are feeling those feels.
Yeah.
But it was very funny when we were shooting their makeout scene. I just didn't call cut for a minute. And I had told, I said like, hey, listen guys, when you start the kiss, you're going to have to turn because I've got this great thing with a light. And if you just sort of lean onto your left foot, we're going to get this beautiful halo effect around you guys. So they didn't get into that position right away. So I kept like rolling, waiting for them to get into that position. And then they sort of got into the position, but it wasn't quick enough. And I'm like, gosh, I cut here. And then I just saw them both getting really uncomfortable. I was like, I'm just going to let this roll. another little bit longer. Let's see how awkward it gets for everybody.
I mean, no one else. I don't think it's just because I know you all so well. That was one time I was like, oh, my God. Because even just the suggestion of just seeing those two, we're like, this isn't right.
I know.
This can't. But
I'm sure it's going to be, whenever we do a press junket for this thing, the number one thing that people want to talk about. But the truth is, when you make a movie, especially something that is as small as this, that has as much such a high degree of difficulty, you want people you can trust around you because you're making certain guarantees to your financier that you'll be able to execute and that it will be good, that you will come away with footage that you can cut into a movie and that footage is going to be compelling and you'll be able to sell it as a whole piece. And so to that end, I needed actors that I knew would know their lines and show up because we weren't going to get more than like one or two takes. We were really – the conditions where we were shooting, it had to happen fast. And so that's what I did. I hired people. I wrote parts for people that I knew could play the parts. And then I hired those people to come in and make sure that I didn't look stupid.
Macaulay Culkin is great in it. Like the guy that he plays.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know him in real life, but he seems like a great guy.
I love him.
And but talk about someone who fame, you know, I mean, we've had this conversation before. It's like, yeah, people write stuff about him and they just make it up. Just like not even remotely true, you know?
And he doesn't do a lot of effort to correct them, you know? I think the biggest thing, he did the podcast for a minute, and I think that gave people a different kind of clarity, and he joined social media, which gives him at least a governing of his own voice.
Yeah.
And so no one can infer his voice in the absence of his voice. He's able to put his own voice out there.
Yeah.
But casting him in this role, again, it was something I wrote for him because I've known him for quite a while now. We got to make a movie together, so I'd known him in the trenches too. And it's not that he doesn't want to work, he's just not going to pursue work. And so if opportunities come up, it's not like he'd say no if it's something he wants to do. He's just not out doing auditions.
Yeah.
So I said, I've written something fun for you. I think it will be a character that you'd fucking crush. And I think that people would love to see you in this. I think that people would love to see how charming and pretty and healthy you are. also, I need this character. I need this character to pop, and you can pop it.
But what do you – I mean, to direct a movie, so many things have to go right.
Yeah.
There's only so much you can control. And so when you kind of basically have to be that, but for an entire three-dimensional production where lighting, acting, music, camera shot, like everything has to go right.
Yeah.
What are you learning, and how did you see that process from the image that was in your head splatted onto a screen?
Well, the upside is I've had more than 30 years experience before I attempted something that challenging. And I'd done, you know, over 40 movies myself and been on probably less than 100 film sets. But like right up there, I've been on tons of film sets, and I've been on tons of commercial sets and TV sets, and I've seen how the process works. And I really understand all of the technical things that go along with making any of this stuff and how important every detail is, every role, everybody that's carrying cable to, you know, what kind of brushes the makeup artist is using. Like, it's all kind of important. And the thing that I've learned the most even as an actor, what you want from your director is someone with a point of view who is decisive but flexible. And so that's what I tried to do. I tried to put together a team. I had very strong producers who I knew I could depend on that would cover certain things. And if anything went wrong in that area, they would bring it to my attention. We would solve it together. And then I was flexible enough to say, I want the best idea, even if it's not my idea.
Yep.
So yes, I know how to tell this story because I know what it is that I'm trying to tell. But I'm open to the idea that there are other ways to do it that maybe I haven't thought of. And also, when conditions present themselves and we're just not going to be able to do it the way that we thought we were, I need to know if what's being suggested will solve the problem or create another problem. And so that's really it. The biggest thing that I learned, which was the most interesting, and plus I had like 15 years of making Robot Chicken.
Yeah.
And in the first, especially in the first five seasons, being a part of every single aspect of that production and understanding things that I had never considered before with respect to financing and post-production and all these mixing and coloring, like all these things I just hadn't done. But having done it over those years, and also knowing that we've got a studio with post-production capability, visual effects capability, sound, and like I knew what we could do at our shop, and I knew the actual hard costs associated with it. So every time we're in a situation in Thailand where we're filming a horizon and there's a new boat that's not going to match in the back of this coverage every time, I'm able to crunch the numbers of, okay, well, that's two guys on a console working about 48 hours, and this is their day rate to remove these things from the horizon. And so I would say to my DP, it's like, well, yeah, if we go down another inch, then I can clean up this whole background, and we don't have to worry about it. And let's just shoot this direction because it won't matter what's back there.
And what they actually put in the background instead of the boat is Boba Fett fighting a doll with a baby head.
There are dozens of Easter eggs in the movie.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah.
I'm
not going to tell you anything about
it. Not any Easter eggs?
No, because this is so long before this movie was coming out.
That's true.
I don't want to tip my hand too much, but I will say, look, you know me, man.
Yeah, I guess that sort of defeats the purpose of an Easter egg if someone tells you. It's like you're not Easter egg hunting and they go, it's behind the bush. You have to fucking find it. You have to fucking find the egg for yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who was the – I just assume he's a UFC guy. Who was the guy who plays the dude who's buying drinks?
Oh, it's Randy Orton. So Randy Orton is a belt holder for the WWE. He
was fantastic.
Great. So Randy and I met because in 2009 I was the first celebrity guest host of Monday Night Raw for the WWE. And I got to GM a bunch of matches, and I wound up in a six-man tag team with John Cena and Triple H versus Randy Orton and The Legacy, which is the young DiBiase and Cody Rhodes. And so Randy and I met that night, and he was not sold on me. Like, they were all a little standoffish about Hollywood infiltrating. And, you know, the WWE, especially in 2009, just hadn't quite crossed over as well as they have in 2018. And so there was this presumption that it is silly or not impressive or whatever the impression is out of Hollywood. And they were sensitive to that. So me coming in there, everyone was a little standoffish. But they saw that I was not just a fan of the company and of those productions, but that I was willing to play at 100%. 100%. I came in there to fucking win, right? And so Randy, because we were opponents, he was like really mad dogging me the entire time. And then we get in the ring and we like physically tussle. And I take a bump from him in the match, and it was a big deal. So, and then after that, but from working with everybody in that situation, I was like, man, I love these guys. I love this whole idea. This is such a great, what an incredible group of professionals. These are top level athletes and performers in the same package. Like, how cool is this? And the truth is, I needed that character Martin to look a certain way. But I also needed him to have a certain presence, a certain gravitas. And I'd gotten to know Randy over a good amount of time. And I was like, man, this is the kind of thing that you would just crush. You would just crush. And that was the best part about it. He was like, so what's the tone of this thing? Oh, this is just conversation, man. This is just you and I talking. So you don't need to project. You don't need to do anything. This is like as real as can be.
And he really was. Like there was no – his performance was so just natural and likable and – I really, really, really thought he was like, I was watching him going, oh, this guy could fucking work a ton.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like an idiot for not knowing that he was Randy Orton.
It's just adjacent. If you don't watch a ton of YouTube or if you don't watch Twitch, you're not going to know who, you know, PewDiePie is or anybody who's got like 10 million followers daily. And you're like, why don't I know this guy?
I know,
guy?
But it's probably like he's literally one of the most famous people in wrestling.
He's pretty well known. Yeah. He's pretty well known, but most of these guys, the general population doesn't know them until they cross over. So like Cena's been huge in WWE forever, but it wasn't until Trainwreck that people were like, oh, who's this Cena guy?
But
The Rock is the same way.
But I have so much respect for what those guys do, even though I don't know who everyone is, because it the level of performance and audience engagement and like on-the-spot story creation and just figuring out really quickly how to tell these stories, who's the good guy, who's the bad guy, simplifying them in a way, but giving them some like depth and dimension, and everyone kind of has their own point of view. I mean, it's and they all have to work together to do it. And on top of that, they have to be the most physically fit titans in the world. And on top of that, like not actually hurt each other at the same time. I mean, like there's so many things that make it work that it's an incredibly respect, and then they have to know how to improvise as well. Like it's an incredibly respectful.
Yeah, I've said over and over again that company is one of the most professional companies I've ever worked with. Like I'm consistently impressed by how well they do the variety of jobs that they do.
And so, what is this? Where's the film now? Like you've shot it, it's done. What are you doing with it?
Well, we started showing it to distributors, and that's what I'm trying to figure out. It's really interesting just because I haven't explored this aspect of the business too much. Everything that I've put out has been with the destination already predetermined. And so, you know, distribution is changing in the last 2 years, let alone the last five. All these vendors, all of these streamers, they just didn't exist 2 years ago in the same way. Like we wouldn't have been talking about Hulu 2 years ago as a first run distributor of, you know, high value content. But it's different now than it ever was. And so I think about this movie, you know, because my goal for this movie is this isn't the type of movie that competes with Infinity War. It's a very small movie. It's a simple slice of life about friends figuring out a problem. And so to that end, I'm hyper conscious about being realistic, not just, you know, oh, you want a huge sensation because you want your name in lights. It's really, how do I get this movie in front of an audience that's going to watch it? I don't think it's for everybody, but I do think that anybody who watches it would enjoy it.
Yeah.
And so it's that. It's like, a bunch of different distributors will put your movie out in theaters, okay? And so you guarantee like a week or 2 weeks of distribution, and you have to support that with an outside guarantee of marketing. So that's advertisements, whether it's internet or in the newspaper or radio or television or posters, billboards, all that advertising costs money. And it's usually a secondary company that puts in that money in exchange for first dollar gross participation. And so whatever that money is that you're spending, somebody's spending that money. That's the first thing off the top of your returns. And so you want that money that's spent on advertising to be really valuable. You want it to people have to know the movie exists, and then they have to be able to see it in a way that's convenient for them. And I know me, I rarely go to the movies anymore. And I know that there's certain things that get me out into a theater, but it's not a lot. Right. And when I ask friends and people in my life, it's the same. There are a handful of things that's going to get somebody into a theater, but not a lot. There's plenty of things that you see and you're like, oh, that looks great. I will wait till it's in my house.
I will wait until I can watch it in my underwear.
I'll wait till it's in my
house. What are you comfortable watching in your underwear and putting on pants for?
Well, so I keep thinking about what my movie really is. And I've been calling it a cinematic vacation because I feel like it does what I love movies to do, which is transport me to some place that I'm not in, some place that I can really get immersed in for the duration of the film and share an experience that's completely outside of my personal purview that may have themes or characters that I can really relate to. Like, that's my favorite thing. So I keep thinking that there's probably a play, like a week, a limited engagement in like a couple of cities, but I've really done the math in my head and there's only a handful of cities where people would go to a theater to see this movie. And that's nothing about the movie. That's just the shape of the marketplace. And so I keep thinking that there's a version of it where that whole marketing money gets spent on, you know, publicity and the actors doing press, but that the movie is released day and date in a limited run in theaters and on VOD at the same time. I think that that's our best bet. Because that way, if I do like Trevor Noah or Jimmy Kimmel, and I'm like, yeah, you could see the movie tonight if you live in New York or Los Angeles, or it's in your house for $3.99. I think that's going to get a lot more click-through for that same marketing spend than if I put all of my effort towards a theatrical run where you just can't guarantee anybody would leave their house to go see it in a theater. And again, nothing disparaging about the film. It's just I know me and I feel like that's the mood of the marketplace.
Well, yeah. And the types of movies that people leave their house for are like Avengers or Fast and Furious, like massive.
Or even like Get Out, something that is a directorial debut from a performer that is such a revelation in so many ways that it becomes a cultural sensation. I don't think that's this movie. It really wasn't what I was aiming for. And I keep going back to that. Like, what was it that I was aiming for? I just had the story. I had the story I wanted to tell. I had this experience that I wanted to share. And that's my whole onus for making the film.
Do you think people are going to... There were a couple times in the movie where I almost thought, is it about to go genre? Like, is he going to get bitten by a wolf? Or is there like a... Because he's going to drink a thing and he's going to turn into a lizard person.
There's a lot of Easter eggs in the movie.
So what... And where's Robot Chicken at this point?
We are writing our 10th season right now.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
That's mind-blowing.
We just finished the third season of Super Mansion. I think it premieres later in the year. And we're making another animated show for Hulu called Crossing Swords. I think that's going to premiere in 19.
Do you feel like you have everything pretty much under control, or do you like to bring yourself to just slightly overwhelmed and that you operate well in that space?
Well, the upside of our shop is I've got three partners who are all really hardworking and super creative, and we all have the same goals as far as, you know, staying in business and making stuff that we believe in. And so all of these things don't need me to be involved in every aspect and every way. And I've tried to take a cue from somebody like Seth MacFarlane, who is gotten very good at delegating responsibility and, you know, empowering all of his admirals and generals to do their best work on behalf of a show that he doesn't have to oversee every detail of. And it's not productive for me to... you know, hold people back because they need to do it my way. That's you're not really building a strong team like that. So I'm trying to, you know, I'm not giving up any of the things that I'm producing, and I'm certainly not going to stop doing that work or participating, but I am also trying to refocus a little on performing, just because I miss acting all the time.
Yeah, it's hard when you start. I know that, but the sentence I'm about to say is really dumb. But when you start getting a lot of opportunities, it's hard to because you want to take all those opportunities because you worked hard for them, and you feel like, oh well, I should do this and I should do that, and I, you know, it would be, you know, am I ungrateful for not taking these? But then at a certain point, you really do have to stop and go, wait, is this? Am all of a sudden, am I in a managerial position? Is this the right thing for me? Yeah. Do I am actually passionate about this anymore? I've gone down this path, and you've sort of unconsciously made a lot of choices that you didn't realize were choices, and you really do have to evolve and sort of see where you're at and make sure that you're still like the path that you're on is still
your path. Yeah.
And not like, oh, I kind of got swept away because I just thought, you know, this path had money or this.
How
path
did I become an A&R guy?
Yeah.
When I was working so hard to play guitar.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And so it is kind of a hard thing to keep mindful of.
I think that's just, you know, meaningful, honest self-reflection. And because I've been at this so long, I have noticed that at several different points in my career, I've had to sort of redefine what it was that I was doing and then make a conscious effort to demonstrate that so that people could see that clearly and weren't misinformed about my intention.
Yeah. And so with Robot Chicken in the 10th season, that pretty much, I mean, you guys have that down at this point.
Well, we're still trying really hard. Like, we were just working on a holiday special this morning, and, you know, we pitched like 50 ideas for it, and it just wasn't quite gelling. And so we're just all sitting there together trying to talk about how to make it something significant and what we've done before and what we want to do. And we're still trying very hard to take advantage of this thing that we've got and make it something new and interesting all the time.
When you finish a season of that show, are you like, I'm done. I got no more jokes. I mean, just because of the number of jokes per episode. Yeah.
I definitely feel at the end of a season like I've completed some kind of marathon. It's usually an entire year or 14 months end to end from the time we start writing to the time we deliver final post on our 20th episode. And it's a volume of work, and it's a tremendous amount of concentration. And the only way that I've survived is to continue to hand off responsibilities to other people that are really great at the job and then trust them to do a good job and empower them to do their best work on our
behalf. That show started at the right time. Because it just,
right?
Like, you caught the wave of when people were still watching television. And so you kind of got grandfathered in because now people are like hardcore fans of it.
Yeah.
I feel like if Robot Chicken started now, it would be a little bit more of an uphill climb of like, how do we compete with everything that's being made right now.
There was also this, it was a very fortunate coincidence where we were making something that was sort of ADD television at a time when people were just starting to share bite-sized content via the internet. And so we got a lot of eyeballs directed at us because people were segmenting out channel flips or individual sketches and sending them to each other without even telling them that it was Robot Chicken.
Oh, wow.
So people just started seeing and sharing little comedic bits without even knowing that they were all talking about the same thing.
Yeah. And so what? When's the next season premiere?
Let's see. We'll start physically filming in February. And so it'll probably be like end of summer. We'll probably premiere some stuff at San Diego next year.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
And then before that, are you guys traveling anywhere? Are you taking some time off?
I'm not taking time off.
He says as he averts his eyes.
Well, I want to make a plan to distribute the movie, and then there'll be a press push around it. I'm hoping that's like towards the beginning of the year, like March or April would seem like the smartest time for this movie to come out when people could receive it without there being so much noise or clutter. And I want to – I'm writing something. I don't know if I want to direct it right now. I'm sort of planning on directing it just because that's the shortest cut to getting it done the way I want to do it. But there's also a part that I want to play in it. I'm a little hesitant to direct something of this scope and play a part in it just because it splits my focus so hard.
I mean, it's so – just thinking about how – you think about a career and, you know, it's like make this movie, get it out, get it done, get it out, do the press, move on to the next thing.
Yeah.
It's like there's no – there's almost there's almost like no goal other than just to keep making stuff.
But I grew up loving guys like George Burns and Bob Hope and Hume Cronin who literally worked their entire life. And it isn't about an end goal. There isn't – it's that quote from Parenthood. It's like you never get to –
it's one of my favorite quotes. You never cross the –
football and do the touchdown dance. You just – you keep going. It's the journey. And that's it. Everybody says that, but it really is the truth. It's all these things I get to do along the way. There is no goal. It's not like, oh, if I won an Oscar, I would quit. Or I feel so lucky. I really do. I just feel so fucking lucky that I have been able to spend my life doing this. And I try to always be, deserving of it is kind of the wrong framework, but more. I try to never be begrudging of my opportunities, and I always try and reprove why I'm supposed to be here.
Yeah. And do you have to constantly check in on yourself?
Yeah. Yeah.
In other words, to not take things for granted, to go like, oh, wait a minute. I think maybe that might be the ego. I don't know.
Yeah, when you're sitting at home, like, wrapped in a blanket, crying uncontrollably, like, why don't I just have this? Why can't I? Nobody was just, and then I can't, I don't even know that I'm just not funny anymore. I can't even, like, I can't memorize these lines. Who am I?
You know what's great about what you just said? And I want people to really, really, really listen to this. It's like having a rewarding life or a successful life or accomplishing things doesn't mean that those moments will go away. You have to understand that people that you look up to or people that make the things that you idolize or George Burns, you know, I'm sure George Burns had moments like that too, that it's not – your life isn't going to be free of stress or free of self-doubt or free of insecurity. You just know those are going to happen, but then it's what do you do after that? What do you do with that? And it's just figuring out how to power through, figuring out how to make opportunities out of opportunities out of obstacles. That's really important for people to hear because I think some people just think like, oh, I'm going to achieve this thing and then I'll never feel that again. It's like, no, you'll still feel worse. Those things because of the pressure.
Yeah. Well, then now you've achieved something that you're afraid to lose.
Yes.
Or you exist long enough that you see some younger you coming up behind you who's just killing it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But for me, I always, whenever I see someone who's younger or hungrier, my instinct is not, oh, I've got to crush that guy. My instinct is like, oh, maybe they want to make something together.
Right. Or maybe they'll inspire you to innovate in a way that you hadn't thought of before.
Yeah. I don't know. I see this whole industry as a community, and you can either take advantage of the friendships that you've got and collaborate with people who you think are awesome and be as awesome as you can be so that they're willing to collaborate with you. But there is no moment where all of your fear or doubt, like every one of us is plagued with just that constant nagging that you're no good, that you shouldn't be here, that you've blown it out and whatever you achieved was just some series of fortunate events and you don't have it anymore. But, you know, that's between you and yourself. Like it really is. It comes down to your own drive, your own ability to What's that? Feel the fear and do it anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. I never feel like totally comfortable right before I step on stage. But when I'm on stage and I've done my work, I've done my prep, I'm not just like going out there and expecting myself to be like magic. I have to have prepared. I have to have stretched or whatever it is, you know.
Yeah.
When I get out there, that's when I feel the best.
Yeah. I mean, I think it – you know, the scary thing is, well, what do you do if you're not excited by anything, you know?
No.
But there's just so much now. I just feel like there's just a
there's just so much that you can do and so many different ways to make art and so many different ways to create.
I wonder if that's – because I meet a lot of younger people now and they are overwhelmed by the limitless possibilities. I find them like almost frozen, you know, because there's – it's like that scene in Moscow on the Hudson where he goes to the supermarket and he
– Boy, another Moscow on the Hudson reference.
Well, because it's such a good thing.
No, this guy, is a great movie.
Robin Williams plays a character from Russia standing in line for, you know, a piece of toilet paper. And then he comes to the U.S. and he's in the supermarket aisle and there's like 5,000 kinds of coffee.
And he doesn't know what to get.
He has a fucking panic attack in the middle of the supermarket because he's like, I don't know. What is this, like, coffee? So I think that young kids, there's a little bit of that.
Well, yeah, because psychologically, humans want choice, but they don't want too much choice.
Right.
Because too many choices creates anxiety of like diminishing returns or like what if I make the wrong choice? It's the same reason why you can go onto Netflix and just go, I don't know. And then you watch previews and go, I don't know anymore. And then you just end up going to bed. You didn't actually watch anything. Or think about the fact that you can go to google.com or whatever your search engine is of choice and literally learn anything about history, anything about anything that's ever been thought of or recorded. You can learn about it, which means think about the power of that.
Yeah.
And you just go to Google and just stare at it and go, I don't know. It's just too much. It's too much choice for one person to have.
It is. But when I was younger and all of this technology wasn't available, I still found ways to make stuff because that's what I needed to do. Mm-hmm. And so I really try and look at all this stuff as just tools for making stuff. So I always say to people that are like, what do I make? I'm like, you're the only one that can answer that. You have to find something that you love, some story you want to tell, some thing you need to help make exist, and then the tools, the infinite tools are all around you.
I also think an amendment to the Jason Robards speech in Parenthood about you never cross the goal line, you never spike the ball. I also do believe that we can have romanticized this idea that we're going to have some like Edison style inspiration that's just going to strike us and go, oh my God, now I got to make.
Right.
When really creation and innovation, I think, is not as romantic as that. It's like you just make stuff and someone goes, well, what do I make? Draw some, write some, don't even think about it. Just start doing it.
Yeah.
And then it'll start to take shape or you'll be able to make it. And then afterwards look at it and go, oh, I didn't want that. But actually it inspires this other idea. Like, but waiting for that lightning strike is also, I think, kind of a false. I mean, that can happen that way.
But pressurizing your own creation, believing that everything you make needs to be perfect, lest it's, you know, nothing more than a stepping stone, instead of just accepting that it's totally okay to make things that nobody sees or nobody likes, and just have that be a step closer to making something that you love, you know?
Yeah.
But you gotta fuck up plenty of times before you even know what fucking up feels like.
Embrace the suck. Yeah.
Nobody starts shooting three-pointers without practicing three-pointers over and over again. So the point that you get into a game and you're like, oh yeah, this is the point. Oh, I'm standing right in the place. I should hit this three-pointer. And you're not always gonna do it. But like, do it, practice, try things, make mistakes just to get the sense memory.
Well, yeah, because some of the best things come from mistakes.
Yeah.
Like, or accidents or fuck-ups or...
Yeah, I tell the story of Robot Chicken all the time because it was not our intent to make a series that ran for 15 years. That's really not at all what we were doing. I had friends and we liked toys and I liked stop motion and I was going to make like a 2-minute sketch to bring on Conan just to have made something. And we fell sort of ass first into making a series for a network that was barely a network at the time. And we all grew together. But, you know, in retrospect, it looks like, oh, wow, you guys were so savvy or the timing, but it really was just like a series of coincidences and us having fun together. And then I feel like the audience sees our fun and that's what they want to be a part of.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure, you know, I mean, when Matt and Trey made Spirit of Christmas,
I'm sure they didn't go like, this is going to be one of the long, this is going to turn into one of the longest running shows in the history of television.
I'm glad you bring them up, though. There's that documentary that I think everybody should watch. Their 6 Days to Air documentary, which shows how fast they make that show, how quickly they go with an idea and just run with it. So you see them bantering, beating out a story, and that exact dialogue that they came up with in the room is the dialogue in the show. And when you watch the show, you think, oh, they must have spent weeks refining this and editing and getting it, and then you're like, no, they just ran with it. Yeah, and it works.
That show is as close to live animation as there is in terms of, and they've really found this pocket of being able to comment on the of like the zeitgeist, like week to week, if they wanted to, and still make it work.
Yeah, I'm always impressed by those guys, and then them running out and making Book of Mormon, like it's just it's a cool
or Stick of Truth.
Yeah, it's just a cool. Yeah, right. you know, it's good. It's good advice. Like, just keep making stuff.
Yeah,
just keep trying.
Yeah, absolutely.
And don't make it all precious.
No, don't make it precious. That's the thing. But precious is, that's kind of where our ego is. You know, like our ego is precious.
Yeah. And I'm anticipating a high volume of negative comments about this movie, which is why I'm terrified to show it to anybody. Because it is, it's deeply personal in that I made it.
Right.
So if you don't like it,
you have to bear all the responsibility for it.
Well, yeah, because there was, at the end of the day, all of the key decisions related to it I had to make. And so if you don't like any of those choices, I'll have to say, sorry, that was on me.
Yeah. And the more personal your thing is, when people reject it, what you really feel like is, oh, they're just saying they don't like you.
Yeah. Well, it's not autobiographical, thank God. But there is a lot of me in this movie. It was all music I loved, or my POV, or
that's what I mean. Like, it's like so emotional, it's deeply personal. Even though it's not your story, it's very personal.
You know, but I have spent my entire career sort of opening myself up to be shit on, and I think that's something that performers just have to be comfortable with. Is that, you know, sometimes you may get a standing ovation, and other times you might get a Rotten Tomato hitting you square in the forehead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But as long as you know that that's the deal.
Yeah.
That does help, right?
Yeah, totally. Because, I might be able to dodge.
Because there are definitely those comments that people can make where you go, they have a valid point. That was a fair criticism.
Yeah.
And then there are other comments where you go, they're going through something. That's maybe a little bit about them, just because of the way that it's expressed. So as long as you can separate.
Haters got to hate.
So as long as you can separate. They got to hate.
Well, there's also this very strange reality, too. We used to just be far more separated from the public, and people felt a lot less entitled to just scream, hurling insults at you, you know? And with the rise of the internet, people feel an access to you, and so they're able to express their own power by saying something shitty, by, like, hurting your feelings in real life. Someone that they don't know, someone who they might respect or admire or even enjoy their work, and in this moment something in their life has made them seek pleasure out of hurting someone else, you know what I mean? And it's not even that they didn't like your thing, they're just like mad. just gotta
remember
make you feel bad for a minute.
I think the year was 1994. I had an AOL account, as a lot of people did.
Sure.
And I went into a chat. This, I'm so embarrassed that I did this, but you know, I was young, and it's right when Singled Out was just starting to take off, and people were talking about MTV, and then it was an MTV chat room. And do you see where this is going?
I do, and I have a similar story.
Oh, thank God! Oh my God, you made me feel so much better. And of course, you know, 22 or 23 year old me goes, "Yeah, but what do you think about that Chris Hardwick guy?" And it's just like, bring, bring, Tool, fucking dork, fucking idiot, piece of shit, stupid. I'm like, what?
Oh, God.
Not one? Pause? You know, and then that was sort of my first lesson of like, if you go seeking for ego treasures, then you will fall into ego traps.
I got a similar lesson, which was, if you believe any of the positive praise that anyone has to say about you online, then you... you have to take all of the negative comments with the same weight and gravity. When Buffy was on the air the message board concept had just begun, and so there were a handful of people on a message board community. And I went on to it just because I had never been on a show where I played a guy that got to kiss the girl. Like, all of my roles were – well, I guess I'd done Airborne, but for the most part, I played, like, the dorky, nerdy, weirdo, creeper, mm-hmm. some version of that. And so in this show, I was playing, like, a guy with a guitar who was kind of cool, and I had had you know, female peers of mine suddenly find me appealing, and that was a brand new experience. So I went on the message boards for just a little bit of that gratification, and I got nothing positive. Just nothing good. All like highly personal observations about my physicality, or just just things that you have no control over, or just like really critical of my performance, or what the fuck is he even doing here? Kind of, there's a lot.
It's the equivalent of it's the equivalent of going to the zoo and going, you know what I should do? I should hop in that pen and pet those lions.
Let's see what's up. I'm going to run at that lion and show him who's boss. It's like, why did I do this?
Lesson learned.
Yeah.
But still, you know, even after all this time, we still have to, you know, like those parts of our personality, the ego parts and the need for acceptance and the sort of need for significance, you know. And I just feel like the older we get, the more it's like, okay, you know, are we placing our eggs in the right emotional basket? So should we instead find significance in places like, you know, are we like, how's our family life? Like, how's our, you know, is my mom okay? Okay, she's all right. My wife loves me. This is like, maybe these are the places, like, rather than what are random people going to say about me?
Well, you know, it's tough because we're performers, and so
it's kind of baked into it.
You want the audience's approval, or you at least want to know that the audience doesn't feel like they wasted their time and money by seeing you. And so there's a natural inclination to need a total saturation of success. Like, you need everybody in that crowd to like what you
did.
And
even if you had it,
yeah,
the weird performer curse is that you would still find a way to be dissatisfied by it in some way, or have it and then immediately go like, oh my God, it's going to go away.
There's that dark thing where if you haven't given 100%, or if you were just a little bit off and the audience still applauds, then you can bear a resentment towards the audience for not knowing the difference between you at 90 and
they don't know 100%. Anything. They were terrible. I was terrible.
They can't possibly know how terrible I was tonight.
Oh, a really good job tonight. Yeah,
fuck
right.
You. What do you know?
You mouth breather. You wouldn't recognize anything good if it shat in your eyes.
You sophisticated, prominent theater owner who spent a solid amount of money
on
this
performance.
How dare you contribute to my success and livelihood?
I wouldn't hire me. Why would you? This is bullshit.
You have no taste.
But then I do think the other side of that is that you can have those moments where you do everything you set out to do, and the crowd might be tepid about it, and you go, you know what? I guess this was just a bad match. Like, yeah. I did everything I felt like I was supposed to do. Like, you can still feel like, as long as you feel like you gave it your best. What are you laughing at?
I'm laughing because I just remembered a Tenacious D lyric. He says, sometimes you listen to your heart. Sometimes your heart cuts a fart. That's the cosmic shame. And it really feels like that way. You know, sometimes your heart just cuts a fart. Nobody wants to smell that shit.
They don't want to smell your heart farts.
Yeah. That sounds like the Neil Diamond song that didn't make it on the E.T. record.
Turn on your heart light.
And your heart farts wherever they go.
Let it fart a happy glow.
Hey, that really smells. Let's get out of here, guys.
Neil, we gotta finish the song. It's good.
No, I hard farted up this booth.
This song was a hard fart. Don't you see? It's a parable.
Cut the tape. We're gonna burn it.
It's an example of itself. Don't you understand?
Yeah.
That's so funny. Your reference bank and my reference bank are like right on top of each other, because there was something else where you had a reference to 3 o'clock High, which I think is one of the best films.
I love that movie.
Of the 80s. Yeah. That a lot of people still don't know about.
Well, it was a particular time, and it didn't play on a lot of cable. So a lot of people, it just sort of, if you don't know it, you don't know it. But it's a lot of amazing things. I really love that movie. Did you see Fist Fight, by the way, the Ice Cube Charlie Day movie?
Oh, no, I didn't see it. Was it good?
It is
same kind of thing?
It is good. It's a similar play. It's they handle a lot of things very well. And it's definitely not toned the same, because 3 o'clock High is like an art film.
It is. And the thing that when you see like all the like whip pans and stuff in the night, like all that stuff that became very popular in the 90s, I feel like there were a lot of things that were derivative of that movie that it doesn't necessarily get credit for.
Well, 3 o'clock High owes a lot to Raising Arizona and the way that it was shot.
Maybe a little Ferris Bueller.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right with Raising Arizona. Just the journey that the director takes you on, rather than just kind of like setting stuff out for you to decide, they're like, we're going to steer and
this is where you're looking.
You're going to like it.
Yeah.
And when it works, it works so, so beautifully.
Yeah. I really love that movie. I'm not surprised more people haven't seen it, but it's definitely something worth seeing.
What other – is there anything else from the – is there any other nostalgic thing that you feel like you kind of – is sort of still like a kept secret that you feel like not a lot of people know about?
I don't know. I don't know. My influences are all over the place. I think that's why I like Stan Lee so much, because he talked about just because you write about superheroes, you should be well-rounded. Like he drew from every area of art and culture to create well-rounded characters, to have an honesty, even though his subjects were, you know, supernatural. I try to learn from all areas, and I find that to be the most inspiring, regardless of the kind of work I want to make.
When was the last time you saw him?
When I saw Stan, it was probably like a month or so before he died, I guess.
Oh, man.
Yeah. How lucky. I feel so lucky to have loved him as long as I did and to get to meet him as many times as I did and to get to do the kind of shit we got to do with him. Like, that's so rare.
Yeah, I mean, it's remarkable that, you know, he even just did so much between – I mean, you think about like – between 80 and 95, he hit a stride. You know, like that's
– Yeah, don't you remember when the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man came out? It was such a big deal, and I read about that the series of checks that he got. He got like $80 million for those movies because it was such a big push, and the way his contract worked, he made a ton of money from it. And I remember thinking, man, that guy, like what a twilight of your career. I would have never assumed that he would spend the next 18 years like just being twice as awesome.
Yeah.
And I always look at the fact that all of the characters he's best known for, he created in his 40s.
Those are the kind of things that are refreshing to hear.
Yeah.
Because
you think it's like a ticking clock. You're like, oh my God, I'm comparing myself to everybody else who's done this by this age. If I haven't done this by this age, I must just not be doing it. But the truth is your path is your path.
You know? Yeah. Like to the fact that Dan Aykroyd was like 34 when Ghostbusters came out. That hurts.
It's crazy, right?
They might have been younger than that, but they were in their early to mid 30s.
Yeah.
When Ghostbusters came out.
But, you know, nothing against Dan Aykroyd, but I'm sure he in present day isn't as satisfied. You know what I mean?
He might be. Who knows?
Who knows? Who knows? I got to imagine if you've had that kind of success at a young age, then you're always sort of chasing that – some version of that high.
But you've always managed to maintain a level of success.
I've never been what I like to call catastrophically famous. I've never
had – But you wouldn't want that.
I don't think that works for me. I think part of why I've been able to continue to work is that people still find me relatable.
Right.
And even though I've gotten to be in movies, I still can speak for the audience. I think that's why I worked so well in WWE, because I'm not one of these hulking superstars. And so the people in the audience can relate to that. Like, that's what they would feel like if they were in the ring. So then if they see me get over in the ring, then it's like a success for all of us.
Right. Yeah. Or they would say, like, I would say cha-ching. That's me. I would say that.
It's ridiculous.
I'm that
guy. There's got to be something about that. I don't know. It's just like, it's such a weird subculture thing, the whole cha-ching thing.
Just as a joke, you should just make a short film about whatever happened to that guy and just have it be some weird dramatic tale.
Did you ever see what Mac did? It was a guy named Jack Dishel did a series of like Lyft driver videos, and one of them was Mac as a Lyft driver.
No.
And it was I think it's called Drivers with a Y. And it played a lot like two Christmases ago. And the implication is that this is Kevin from Home Alone. Had he grown up? And he's like really fucking traumatized about his parents leaving him alone and these two burglars that tried to break into his house. And he had to like fight them off.
And they followed him to New York.
They tried to hurt him. And he's like really fucking traumatized by it. I thought that was a very – that's all it reminds me of. It's like if I did Some Where's the Cha-Ching Guy Now. It would have to take as dark a turn as that.
Of course it would have to take a dark turn.
Yeah.
Because there's no – that was 1992. That would have been 26 years ago. Yeah, like that guy had a journey.
You know what's funny is my hair for the first time in 20 years is as long as it was in that commercial.
Oh, your hair wasn't like down like way longer than that?
In X-Files, it's like past my shoulders. But in Airborne – it's like right around my chin. And in the cha-ching commercials, it's mostly bangs. It's like early 90s. I was still into skateboarding.
Do you do any of that still?
Skateboarding?
Yeah.
I mean, I can still like ollie a curb, but I quit. I got my driver's permit the year people started kickflipping. Mm-hmm. And so I missed an entire evolution of skateboarding.
I feel like now would be one of those things where you go, like, it'd be really fun to do this. Oh, but I just pulled the thing and now I'm out for 8 weeks.
Yeah, I'm not going to be the guy who tries to impress my kid by being Marty McFly on a skateboard and like break my back while I'm doing it. I just don't want to be that guy.
My challenge with the kid, you know, because we're talking about it now. And my challenge with a kid is to not be like, don't sit there. Look out. Oh, be afraid of that. Be terrified of that thing. Don't do that. Don't put your finger in there.
I had
stop. Don't eat that.
I had a Dax came over to my house at one point with his daughter, and they were hanging out in the pool. And, you know, it's a lot of rocks around our backyard. And so I'm really nervous about lawsuits. And I said, oh, should we watch her on these steps? And he was like, nah, she's going to make her own mistakes. And I looked at him like, oh, that's pretty terrifying. He was like, how much did you like your parents holding your hand?
Right.
And I was like, oh, that's a really good point. I became independent and I became tough and I learned a lot of basic lessons by fucking up and getting hurt. And if you deny a child that kind of education, then you're really stifling their own preparedness.
That's a great point.
Isn't that cool? Yeah, I was really impressed by the way they're raising those
and
kids.
Also very parallel to what we were talking about before, about like you have to sort of just go through stuff and make mistakes and fall down and
you know
fall down on the rocks in the corner of a pool.
I mean, you got to govern your kids obviously and like teach them boundaries, and you can't just give them awards for showing up or else they're going to grow up really entitled with a lot of expectation. But and I think about this a lot because I grew up out here around a lot of like kids of rich or famous people. And I saw all sides of it, like the secret after school stuff or like, you know, the proms and whatnot. And just it's different now than it was 20 years ago. The things that kids are exposed to at a young age, it's so I'm terrified of that, of like introducing a kid into this environment or setting them up for failure just by having them be my kid.
Yeah.
You know, but you can't. I can't do that or else I'll deny them the basic opportunity to become themselves.
Yeah.
If I'm like too up their ass about how I would do it, then I'll never get to know how they would do it.
That's the message. Don't deny yourself the opportunity to become yourself.
Yeah.
Allow yourself to just start things, make mistakes, learn from them, get better, and embrace the process.
Yeah. If my parents had restricted me the way I'm inclined to restrict a kid, I would never be who I am.
I wonder if some of that has to do with also like
maybe being a potentially old, like a lot older of a parent. If you're like 20 and you have a kid, you're still barely not a kid. So you're like, I don't know, they'll be fine.
Yeah.
But then when you're older, you're like, so many things can go wrong.
Maybe. I do like that I'm older than my folks were just because I feel like I'm more together.
Yeah. Oh, 100%.
I feel like I'm more calm. I feel like I'm more comfortable with myself. I feel like I've learned a lot of things over a distance. So I've really gotten to see how things that I would think are so terrifying play out over a term. And I think that's good. I'm glad I didn't have a kid earlier because I think I would be nowhere near as well prepared.
So lastly, what are you excited about? Like what thing in general? Is there anything particularly that excites you in the world? Anything in the world?
Yeah, I'm excited by a lot. I feel like we're in a golden age of content, even though it's almost impossible to watch it all. I feel like if you have an idea and you're willing to do the work, that you can make almost anything right now. And that's very exciting to me. So, you know, I'm trying to do my part, find fun people to collaborate with. And I'm less urgent about proving myself than I am interested in participating. And so, like, even with this thing that I'm writing with someone, I'm not trying to prove myself. Like with Changeland, even, it's not like, look at me, I'm a director. It's more, I wanted to tell the story, and it was a matter of course for me to direct it because no one else would be able to execute this as inexpensively as I was able to, and no one would know the shorthand of the things that I was trying to express better than me. So I was the right choice for it.
I hope people get the opportunity to see it soon. It's such a beautiful story, and it's such a simple story, and it's just so well done, and everyone in it's great.
Oh, thanks, man.
And I saw so many, you know, saw Matt Cohen in there. Like, yeah. I just see so many people. Yeah, like, oh, that's awesome that they popped up in the thing.
There are so many. I threw people in everywhere. Like, every scene. Like our financier, one of our the guys from the hedge fund is in a scene, and like a Patrick Stump who did our music is in a scene. Like everybody's in the movie.
And I'm telling you, I said that I texted you this when I saw it, but the guy who plays Suchin needs a sitcom.
Oh yeah, it's guys Kenneth Wan.
He was
that
great.
Guy. He was a local hire, and I really love him in the movie.
And again, you know, I think. We first met in like 1994 or something like 93, 94.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm so appreciative that we're still friends, and I'm so appreciative that we've become really close friends over the years.
Me too, man.
I mean, I adore you, and I fucking love Claire, and I just think you guys are so great and just inspiring. And it's great to have friends in your, you know, to have a friend group that you respect and are also inspired by and drive you to be better and more creative. So I really appreciate that.
It's mutual, man. You've always been a consistent and inspiring person. Your willingness to never quit and your insistence on always evolving and learning, like that's so admirable.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, man.
Well, congratulations on everything. Seth Green, you've been on the podcast again.
Yeah.
See you again in 6 years. No, you got to come on. Come on sooner. Then.
I'll probably see you this weekend.
I'll probably see this. We don't have to podcast everything. We're going to podcast every interaction that we
have. What if we did? We're just like Madonna and Warren Beatty. Like.
Oh, yeah. People would
traveled nowhere
without
a camera crew.
Yeah, that's right. It's that scene in Truth or Dare where he's just so fucking over all of it. Why would you do anything if it's not on camera? Like, it's so, like, that was such a window into their...
That was a moment, though. Yeah. That was a moment when the concept of reality TV was being born right in front of us.
It was just born, it was just so beautifully shot.
Yeah.
But just that he was just over it.
Totally different generation. He's like, you know, the audience is only supposed to see what we show them. They're not supposed to see the gossip or the behind the scenes. That's,
well, you know, if you don't want that, don't date Madonna, I guess. I don't know. I mean, it's like you made the choice to date Madonna. Like,
don't you
maybe
think
you'd
when
have
he was
to
making
know.
Dick Tracy, who was like, who's this Madonna character? And he just thought, hey, let's go out a couple times. And then before he knew it, he's backstage at Madison Square Garden with a fucking camera crew.
Not knowing how to just be himself. I don't want any of this. What the fuck?
Yeah, sunglasses inside and just like fist in his jaw. Like, I'm so mad about it. This is great. We were on the wrap up, and I wanted to manage to throw in a last reference.
That was a great, you know, like landing on a Dick Tracy, like sticking the landing on a Dick Tracy reference in a Truth or Dare reference with Warren Beatty.
Yeah.
I think is that – I don't think like that should be a new meme of just him back there. Like when people try to get too much attention on social media, just that him, like you said, with just that – with his hand in his face, just like, why do anything if it's not on camera?
That's a great meme. We should make that the second this is over.
We should make that happen whenever someone just like clearly like makes a thing where it's like, yeah, just – you don't need to, you know, just cut to that sourpuss shot of him in the background.
We'll find that frame.
All right. We're going to meme it.
Well, thanks for listening, kids.
Thanks, kids. Okay, time to go to bed. Or don't. We're not here to direct you your experience. Yeah. Like,
I'm not trying to inform your life.
The funny thing is, like, could we vamp for another hour of just
easily?
Like, I mean,
I would not quit this.
All right, I guess we better stop.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
And bye. Bye now.
No, you hang up. I'm just listening for you to
hang
up.
I love you more. I love you the most.
You don't love me the way I love you.
Oh, my God. This got really serious.
I'm coming over.
Oh my, I'm already here.
I'm actually calling you from the driveway.
Chris.
What?
Chris, I'm here.
But why are you?
I'm outside.
What are you doing in my driveway again?
I told you, I'm just waiting for you to answer the door.
What am I supposed to do when I answer
the door? We've got to come up with a better ending to this podcast. Come on.
I told you, there's no way. We've exhausted every angle.
Let me in now.
If I let you in, can we end the podcast?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to open the door.
Okay. Thank you for letting me in. I just wanted to podcast for a couple hours more.
Oh, God damn it. I just said this wouldn't happen.
I admit I misled you. But it was all for entertainment purposes.
I'm going to bite the cyanide pill that's disguised as a tooth, just like in Dune.
I've already done it.
And dead. Best way to end a sketch you don't know how to get out of. We both die.
Seth's pointing to himself that he's...
At the cyanide pill. I got to commit to this bit.
He was trying to get credit for... committing to the bit, and you guys
can't see it. Yeah. That's good. It's a reasonable end.
You know they can't see what you're doing.
It's the magic of radio. It's the magic of permanently curated audio content.
Oh, Jesus Christ, I'm hitting stop.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law and Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.